proceed to the second case of the day, McMullen versus Medtronic. Mr. Healy.
May it please the court, I am Patrick Healy representing Jack and Barb McMullen, and also President Court is my co-counsel on this case, Steve Kurowski. This case is actually exceedingly simple, and the easiest way to approach it is by, let's exclude what this case isn't about. It's a products liability case. It is premised on a post-sale duty to warn. There is no claim of any defect in the product. There is no claim of any design problem with the product. The McMullens feel this was a godsend product. Jack had onset of Parkinson's symptoms when he was 37 years old, at approximately 1985. As often happens with that disease, medication became progressively less effective and required larger and larger doses. He was implanted in May of 2000 with, it's an off-label use, of two Activa tremor control systems, which is now known as the Activa Parkinson's control system. It's the same thing. It's whether you have two cars in your garage or one car. The results were so beneficial to Jack McMullen that Keith Cage, and this is in an affidavit of Jack McMullen that is attached to our motion for summary judgment on the record. Keith Cage, a liaison for Medtronic, kept on referring to Jack as the poster boy for the Activa system.
I don't see where in the statute you find any basis for your suit. Because the statute seems to clearly require that the states not try to impose warning requirements that differ from the federal. That seems to be what's involved here. I don't know. Must have something to latch on to here, but I wasn't clear what.
Judge Posner? What we are latching on to, first of all, it was filed as a state court action.
Yes, I know that, but of course it's based on what you believe is the violation of a common law duty to warn about this danger that was discovered after the, you know, label went on. So that's fine. I mean, that's perfectly good theory, but you have to find something in this federal preemption statute that allows this kind of this imposition of this additional state labeling requirement.
Judge Posner, I think we can do that by, let's jump to Lohr for 1 second.
Jump and to where?
Lohr versus Medtronic.
No, the statute, right? You have to find something in the statute. No,
Judge Posner, what statute are you referring to?
The preemption provision in the medical device amendments to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act.
If you have Section 360.
Right.
Five justices in Lohr.
Now, you've got to find something in 360. Just tell me what's in 360 that you rely on.
That this is not a requirement different from or in addition to the requirements that are imposed by the FDA.
I don't understand that because they have, you know, requirements and requiring about this warning about the diathermy isn't one of their requirements. So,
Judge, in Lohr, which is the governing U.S. Supreme Court case on this subject until it is altered, in Lohr, five judges found that in order to be informed on Section 360, you had to then, in turn, look to what the FDA has done with that in terms of their regulations. Although Judge O'Connor, in her dissenting portion, said it was a Chevron preemption.
You're getting much too complicated. Look, now, Justice Breyer's opinion is essential to the majority, right?
Correct.
So don't we have to look at Justice Breyer's opinion? That's sort of the narrowest statement of the majority holding. And if we do that, I'm just curious where does Justice Breyer or anybody get back to the statute, right?
Footnote 16. In Section 5, of Judge Stevens' opinion in which all five members of the court wholeheartedly concur refers to Federal Regulation 814.39.
Now, where does Justice Breyer wholeheartedly concur in that footnote? I don't understand.
He, Justice Breyer, states in his opinion that he concurs wholeheartedly with all portions of the court's opinion. There are six sections in lower. He said, except for 4 and 6. He said, I don't agree with 4 because he found that the preemption issue in Cipollone, which was discussed in Section 4, really did not have any application to the lower issues.
So you're pointing to a footnote by Justice Stevens, which is not in 4 or 6?
It's in 5.
Okay, so
that's a majority.
Note 16. All right.
I've never used the phrase before, but it's a majority footnote.
Okay.
What you have in that footnote is a provision that the FDA uses saying that if you find out about a danger, you can issue a warning for patient safety.
Right. That seems far away from imposing a requirement on the manufacturer under state law, right?
Judge, here's what you have in this case.
Wait, before you leave your footnote 16, I don't see how footnote 16 bears on the case. Because all it says is a manufacturer can change the label. It, you know, discovers an additional hazard. So it can make a labeling change that would enhance the safety of the device without prior FDA approval. That's fine. That's not what's involved here. This manufacturer, your whole point is the manufacturer didn't take advantage of this provision to change its label. So that's the opposite of footnote 16. That's why I say you have to tie this through law or anything you want. You've got to tie it back into the statute to find an exception to this very broad preemption provision.
Well, I think that Your Honor would agree that the FDA, under the MDA, can establish requirements that manufacturers must follow.
Of course, and that's not the case either.
In this case, Judge, when they received FDA approval for the unilateral system, but just the Activa tremor control system, an explicit condition of that approval was tracing every single Activa system to the patient.
Right, and they did that, and they notified the FDA. But that's not an exception to the preemption provision.
If you look at this court's decision in Mitchell, what this court said in Mitchell is that there is no preemption. Let me quote the court. In order to determine whether a common law cause of action is preempted by the
page are you looking at?
I am looking at page 3 of the reply brief.
Page
912 of the Mitchell decision.
Okay.
And that the court said, in order to determine whether a common law cause of action is preempted by the action of the FDA, it is necessary to examine the state law cause of action at a sufficiently precise level of generality to determine whether the final judgment of the state court would impose on the manufacturer a burden incompatible with the requirements imposed by the FDA. The FDA has imposed requirements that this be tracked to each individual recipient, and the purpose of the tracking, and I think it is in Regulation 821, is patient safety and patient notification. So we have a situation where federal requirements say, no, every single person who has one of these devices, in case there's a problem with the devices, so there can be prompt notification. I have submitted a letter of opinion from Casper Aldrichs, who is, let me get his title,
Wait, I'm lost. What is it you think? First of all, I can't find this place in Mitchell. Where is this?
It is at page 912.
912. Find it.
And there's a reference to
what paragraph? What is the first line of the paragraph?
It's not the first line of the paragraph.
What is the first line of the paragraph in which it appears? Try to find it.
I do not have my copy of Mitchell here, Judge. I managed to bring the previous Mitchell copy with me, and not the one that the court referenced. But
okay, all right, I found it.
Okay.
So you say. In order to common law, it's necessary to examine a state law cause of action at a sufficiently precise level of generality, etc. Now, the state law cause of action here is a failure to warn, right?
Correct.
But the statute doesn't allow the state to impose additional warning requirements.
I disagree with your Honor, respectfully.
I don't see anything in Mitchell which reads on that. I don't get it.
What the statute permits is the FDA to establish requirements. And, in fact, here the FDA did exactly that. It established requirements to track to the ultimate patient, so you would be able to notify the patient in case there are new dangers discovered. And, indeed, there were new dangers discovered here. And they were discovered.
Where does the statute say that if new dangers are discovered, the state can require a warning of them?
The statute says that a state cannot impose a requirement different from or in addition to, and when it's read in the context it's been interpreted, requirements the FDA establishes. And this court in Mitchell is saying you look at it, and you then determine whether it's incompatible with the requirements of the FDA. And here it clearly is not. It is totally in line with the requirements.
Look, Mitchell upheld preemption for most of the claims. All it said was, to the degree these claims may be read to allege that Culligan, the defendant, failed to meet the standards set forth in the PMA process, the allegations are not preempted. But this case isn't like that. There's no suggestion that, is there, that any federal requirements were violated here?
Surely. I think that what you have under a federal regulation, 821 of the FDA, 821 says patient notification is one of the interests we have here. If you read the letter of Casper Aldrichs, he said, that's our policy. We want these warnings to go out. That is what the FDA is saying. We have a letter from a high-ranking official of the FDA saying, that's the scheme. We want them. We encourage them to warn.
Mr. Healy, doesn't 814 and 360 contain language that the secretary may manufacturer may change warnings? It isn't very directory, the language. It isn't a shall. It seems to be a looser language, which I think arguably tips toward the
all I can say is to have federal requirements of tracking to the ultimate recipient for the purpose of warning in case of danger. And he said, you have to do that. You've got to follow everybody. They have his home phone number. You have to have his home address. You have to have all of that. But then to turn around and say, well, that doesn't mean the FDA actually wanted them to issue a warning, I don't believe that makes any sense.
Well, there's nothing illogical about the argument that you present. I guess the question is, though, is there another balancing of interest that caused the federal preemption to tilt toward a different conclusion. I'm not suggesting for a moment that the warning is
I have been involved in the case a good period of time, Judge, but no, I don't think there is anything that would go the other way.
What about
the
timing?
The problem is, though, I mean, your position, the FDA loses control because you're saying that the FDA has required a certain warning. Now they do tracking and they discover some new danger. Now they're changing the label without getting the authorization of the FDA.
That is correct. They are entitled to
do confusion. They're required to do something by the FDA. Then state tort law comes along. They add other warnings. FDA might not like that warning that is added about the diathermy.
There are time periods, Judge. After they do issue such a warning, they do have to file with the FDA an explanation of why they're doing it.
So they change all their labels, and then the FDA says, oh, we don't like that change. We want you to do something else. Right? That's what your process envisages.
But indeed here, when they issued a warning, it clearly warned against any diathermy treatment for the danger of induced currents.
What about the timeliness? I mean, how soon after they have some information that there's a danger?
Judge, I think what is informative in that regard is the fact that when they issued the warning, which was May 18th of 2001, when that warning was issued, they issued a warning regarding not only this system, they issued a warning regarding virtually every implant system that they manufactured, and each one was an induction of a current resulting in damage at the implant point of the electrode, which is exactly what happened here. So they had a lot of information. We know they had from the MAUDE database notification in January of an individual who was killed through an induced current with the same implant system that Jack McMullen had. To say that the danger is known and the federal government is somehow restricting or preempting issuing a warning when all other federal requirements say you must do.
Not preventing issuing the warning, it's preventing a state lawsuit. That's what it's preventing.
Justice O'Connor dismissed Medtronic's claim in that regard in the Lohr case when she said having a state lawsuit is a further incentive to comply with FDA requirements. And that is what is sought here, is let's have timely compliance with FDA requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Healy. Mr. Brown.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Brown on behalf of Medtronic. I'm here with my co-counsel, Kevin Knight. The premise of plaintiff's argument is that Medtronic had a mandatory duty to warn patients like Mr. McMullen directly, within hours, presumably by telephone, of even a single adverse event involving the product he had. But even the appellants don't dispute that the pre-market approval process and resulting conditions of approval create device-specific federal requirements that can have preemptive effect. This court said so 7 years ago in Mitchell versus Collagen. It's also undisputed in this case that the device that Mr. McMullen received had FDA-approved and mandated warnings covering both diathermy and electrocautery. So the question is, are these new warning obligations that the appellants would like to impose on Medtronic, do they create state requirements that are different from or in addition to the federal requirements? And the answer I submit is that they are, regardless of whether they deal with content or timing, very much different from the federal requirements for the following reasons. Number one, all of the warning obligations for a device that goes through a process like this, the pre-market approval process, which is not all medical devices, are governed by specific federal requirements, not state common laws. Second, the fact that a manufacturer can seek to change a federal requirement, like it can do for any requirement governed by regulation or law, does not mean that while the federal requirement remains in existence, different state requirements should not be preempted. Third, the federal tracking regulations and the temporary warning regulations in 814.39, which are associated with the pre-market approval supplement process, do not create any federal requirement affirmative duty to warn. So therefore, they are not parallel to any state requirement. And fourth, a jury verdict in a case like this, determining that there is such a warning obligation, is the type of behavioral or standard of care requirement that Justice Breyer in Lohr and this court in Mitchell said would be preempted.
What are electrocautery and diathermy?
They are they're not devices that we make in Medtronic, but they are devices. They're kind of deep heating devices used by sports therapists and chiropractors, and they relax
the
muscles.
Why do dentists use it? What do dentists use it for?
Well, in this particular case, Your Honor, it was to remove or cut tissue, and there was a dispute about whether or not it was electrosurgical and whether or not it was electrocautery versus diathermy. But the fact, and we disagree with the appellants on that, but for these purposes...
What's the difference between them?
I'm sorry,
What's the difference between electrocautery and diathermy?
Well, electrocautery removes tissue, whereas diathermy merely heats the tissue, as I understand it. I don't claim to be an expert on either diathermy or electrocautery, but that's as how I understand it. And so, and in this...
How many of these devices that the plaintiff in this case had implanted exist in the population?
Your Honor, I don't know for sure. It's in the thousands, and I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 or more, but I don't want to be held on that. Okay. But I think in this case in particular, a finding of no preemption would be particularly unjust because Medtronic did what it was supposed to do. It worked with the FDA, and it figured out a very complicated and challenging problem that was not a problem related to a defect in its device, but rather a problem with the interaction of a totally different treatment therapy, diathermy, and then notified a very large and disparate group of healthcare professionals and patients directly, and then proceeded to have the new warning language approved by the FDA pursuant to the pre-market approval supplement process, which is what it was supposed to do. Nowhere did the FDA suggest that the timing or conduct of Medtronic was...
How long did it take between the discovery of the problem and the new notice or notice to physicians?
Medtronic got notification of the first adverse event on January 10, and the new warnings that went out, well, I say to the world, to this very large group of healthcare professionals and patients, went out May 16th to healthcare professionals, 2 days later, May 18th, to patients directly.
And so the accident here was in between, presumably.
Yeah, that was in March, Your Honor.
Was this a warning to, as you track the physicians in the case of the implant people, were directly to those physicians, or was this a general notification to the medical profession or healthcare providers?
To both, Your Honor. Not to the entire medical profession, but to those healthcare professionals that we understood were involved in diathermy. And again, a group of healthcare professionals that Medtronic ordinarily doesn't have much contact with. Chiropractors, dentists, sports therapists. We sent notices to competitors that had any kind of... We wanted to get the word out. And in addition to, certainly, those healthcare professionals that implanted the Activa device as well. And so, again, even the medical profession, the case report that this incident generated, January 10th, was published in the Journal of Neurology in the month of May, the same month that we gave our notification, again, on an expedited basis. The figuring out aspect of this problem was not easy, and it's not something that's conducive to what the appellants want to suggest, that you should have a two-hour warning. Once you get the report, shoot first and aim later. That's not how the FDA permits even the reporting of adverse events, much less the evaluation and investigatory aspects of it. These post-sale duty to warns are one of the fundamental flaws, I believe, in the appellant's argument is this, and that is that somehow warnings and post-sale activities are less heavily regulated by the FDA than they are leading up to approval. That's simply not the case. The FDA controls all post-approval activities, including warnings. We are obligated to give continuous updates to the FDA. We have very strict reporting requirements of adverse events, and the FDA ultimately makes a decision in a very serious case whether and when to recall. These duties were talked about and discussed just last month by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in a case called QPEC versus Medtronic that the court and counsel received pursuant to Rule 28J. And in that case, the plaintiffs also made a post-sale failure to warn claim and a post-sale failure to recall claim. And the district court denied allowing plaintiffs to add those two causes of action because they would indeed be preempted because they would impose duties on the manufacturer, Medtronic, that would be different from or in addition to the federal requirements. Last year, in the Third Circuit, in Horn versus Thoratec, also dealt with a similar issue. Among the many claims the plaintiffs made there was that the manufacturer should have sent out a warning in the form of Dear Doctor letters, similar to our safety alerts, and didn't do so. In that particular case, the Third Circuit asked the FDA expressly to weigh in on all of the issues in the case, and the FDA did submit an amicus brief and gave a comprehensive discussion about, at least in its view, that the PMA process creates a preemptive effect on most state tort law claims, including failure to warn. And if I could address a couple of the specific points about this 814.39, the implication is that the manufacturer can just warn without FDA approval. That's not the case. The general rule is that the manufacturer cannot change the warning without FDA approval. 814.39 provides a very narrow and limited exception. It's important to read the language of the regulation. What it says is that the manufacturer may add or strengthen a warning before it receives receipt of the FDA's order approving the pre-market approval supplement application. Thus, it is very much tied to the fact that the manufacturer has to submit a pre-market approval supplement application, and the warning can go out before the FDA issues its approval of that. And the Eighth Circuit dealt with this specific regulation in the Brooks versus Halmedica case and described these warnings as temporary. They still must be approved.
Well, what if the manufacturer doesn't apply for a supplemental supplemental label, whatever, it decides to live dangerously? What is there a legal remedy?
There is, Your Honor, not a private right of action by individuals McMullins, but certainly the government can, under 337, bring a suit. And frankly, this is something that, while is not a paper tiger, as the FDA mentioned at page 27 of its amicus brief in Horn, another manufacturer was fined $92.4 million for failing to report adverse events. And so clearly they can do that. So we would then be in violation of our reporting of adverse event requirements.
Okay, but suppose you report the adverse events to the FDA, but you don't ask for a change in the label. You don't ask for approval of a label change. So what happens then? The FDA can tell you?
The FDA can tell us, look, we've got this adverse event. And again, it's not just one. These come in all the time. In fact, they require us to do trending analysis to see whether or not are we seeing a pattern here. And they can ask for that information if they have. We already provided the individual adverse event reports. And if they say, you know, look, we don't like what we're seeing here. We want a change in the warning. We want a public health notification. We'll come in and inspect your plan. They've got a host of things that they can do.
Given those powers, what is your incentive as a manufacturer to invoke the 814.39? Why wouldn't you always just wait and see what the FDA made you do?
Our incentive, as it was here, Your Honors, we had a situation. There needed to be some time to figure out the problem, however.
And I understand. But there comes a point where you think there should be a label change. My question is, why do you apply for approval for a supplemental label or something rather than simply wait for the FDA to tell you?
Because if we're aware of something that we believe is a risk and that patients should know and should be in the indications and contraindications, what this was something that we should that people who are using this device should know about. And that's the kind of continuous updated information.
Would that be just an ethical duty, or would there be some legal advantage to you to proposing this label change rather than waiting for the FDA to tell you?
There's not a legal advantage to us, Your Honor, but there is. The regulations do obligate us to provide continuous updates on safety information and to report adverse events and to propose changes that we feel are appropriate.
You're required to propose changes, or you're authorized to propose changes?
We're authorized to propose changes. And again, as it relates to that particular statute, again, 814.39, a fair reading is that you may may do it. Actually, Judge Aldrich of the First Circuit, in a preemption case called King versus Collagen, in a concurring opinion, while talking about this particular regulation, said to read may as should would, quote, unravel the entire garment. And I think what he meant by that is that the exception then, which it is a limited exception, would swallow the rule, because there would be this mandatory duty to report every adverse event, and then every person would have a non-preempted failure to warn claim there. That would also lead to other anomalous results, because right now, traditional failure to warn claims are preempted. Most of the courts that have dealt with the issue say that. And that's based on the premise that a plaintiff says you knew or should have known about a particular danger and didn't provide any information other than what's in the label. That right now, that's a preempted claim. Here, it would be, we've got an FDA-approved label, we get new information, we do provide an update and new labeling, but we're subject to a non-preempted claim because we didn't do it quick enough.
When these warnings went out, did they go to the patients or just to the healthcare providers or the profession in general?
Both, Your Honor. For those that, again, this device is a tracked device, and so it went to both the patients. Patient notice went out 2 days after the healthcare professional one. We always want to have the healthcare professionals know first, because the patients are going to be calling the healthcare professionals. That's part of what the notification said as well. And so, and with respect to the tracking regulations, I think there's some ambiguity there. One, I think the district court perhaps said it best, in that there really is a logical disconnect to read in an affirmative duty to warn when, in fact, there's a duty to track. Now, yes, indeed, the regulation says one of the purposes of the tracking regulations is so that they are necessary so that the effective remedies of the prescribed act can occur. But the remedies that are mentioned in the tracking regulations are two, recall and notification, that are authorized by the FDA only under Section 518A and Section 519.
Mr. Brown, how timely is the tracking regulation? How does that – I mean, you're making sales periodically, obviously, and as incident – are reported to the manufacturer, do you accumulate them and then 30 days submit them? I mean, what is the procedure for passing on to the FDA the information?
Okay. Those are medical device reporting regulations, different than tracking. There are three different levels. One is 5 days for what I'll say is extremely serious. I don't remember the language. 15 days and 30 days. And so, again, even from a policy standpoint, the idea that the tort system could provide a better mechanism when under 5 days or 15 days the manufacturer has to report and the FDA can then make a reasoned judgment in conjunction with the manufacturer whether or not some warning should take place and who the warning should go to. It may be that it's not the same in each case. Lastly, the court below, we also made a summary judgment on the grounds that there was no evidence that the device was defective. I think the appellants have conceded that here, but also that there's no causation. Again, the device came with FDA-approved warnings, which I believe were adequate as a matter of law. There's also nothing in the record to suggest that the doctor who put in the device would not have put in the device had he received this contraindication about diathermy, especially since there was already a caution against diathermy. So in concluding, let me just say that the facts of each preemption case are a little bit different, but the analytical framework remains the same. I think the court reached the right result in Mitchell and would urge, and I think that this claim also would be preempted, and I would urge the court to affirm the district court opinion. Thank you very
much. Thanks, Mr. Healy, your time would expire, but you had extensive questioning, so you may have a couple of minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. First of all, with regard to this particular device and the change in the warnings, counsel just referred to, we warned about diathermy. Here was the initial warning on diathermy prior to this occurrence. The effects of diathermy on patients with an implanted neurostimulation system are unknown. Then it said, don't have diathermy directly over your implant site. The warning that came out subsequently, a warning that was issued without any FDA approval, they finally woke up and they just sent this out. That warning said, don't have diathermy, it will result in severe injury or death. It's quite a change in warnings. With regard to
the issue of causation, all of us have blind spots, and hindsight is 20/20. What happened here, and there is an affidavit from Dr. Leslie Geddes, who is the distinguished professor emeritus at Purdue, and that's not my appellation, that's his title, distinguished professor, describing that this is a simple induction of an electrical current. This is not rocket science. And in fact, last night I got an old dictionary out, and the first definition of induction is the process by which a body having an electric or magnetic properties produces magnetism, an electric charge, or an electromotive force in a neighboring body without contact.
But do you agree with what your opponent says, that basically you're arguing that the duty to track implies a duty to warn?
The duty to track, I think, not only implies it, but our letter of opinion from Casper Aldrichs of the FDA states that that is the nature of the system. That's what we want to have happen here. And that indeed is a...
But there's nothing in the statute to suggest that.
In terms of 360, Judge, yes. I would say that is correct. However, most courts have taken 360 and then been informed regarding its application by the actions of the FDA.
Mr. Healy, let me ask you a question. What would be your response to our colleagues in the Eighth Circuit, which warn against a multitude of warnings might result in a deterrence to beneficial use of these devices and impact a national policy? I mean, obviously there's a trade-off when you talk this way, but
you have a limited number of people. Medtronic is the largest manufacturer of implantable devices in the world, and counsel, I think, was probably quite accurate, and I will defer to him. You're somewhere in the tens of thousands for this particular kind of device. I think the court also has to be informed is what's the nature of the danger. It's not slippery floor. It is severe injury or death. I would also have this court note that with regard to Kemp, the Kemp court, and the new case cited says it's following Kemp, the Kemp court explicitly notes that the plaintiff in that case could have made an argument that the manufacturer acquired information after the PMA process and that that is a cause of action for a post-duty to failure to warn. And Kemp didn't say, gee, that's valid. It said that could possibly be a very valid cause of action, but it was not properly pursued by the court until after the motion for summary judgment was granted.
Mr. Healy, we've gone through all this, the argument. Are these devices any visible sign? Can you know somebody has it implanted?
What happens is the device is placed in the bilateral one. Holes are drilled in the head. There is an insertion of the device with the electrodes, in this case in the subthalamic region. And then there is a power generator source that's under the skin. And one of the things that is most noteworthy
about the question, is it visible?
You can see if Jack were here.
Did the dentist know that he had these implants?
Yes, he told the dentist.
So you sued the dentist?
The dentist was... an action filed in Indiana, but the dentist was not notified at the time of the dental procedure.
Has that been settled, or is that a pending?
No, as a matter of fact, there has been a ruling. You have to go through a hearing process in order to be able to bring
malpractice,
the suit.
Indiana malpractice.
Correct.
But Judge Posner and I are both asking, if he's wearing a shirt, can you tell that there's an implant?
No, I think it's a wonderful device, and it should be kept on the market. One last thing I would say, though, is if you go to the advisory committee website or have your clerk do it, there is no theoretical understanding of how this works. It just is something.
Of course, you have enough lawsuits, wonderful devices may be withdrawn from the market.
If we have enough lawsuits, there will be improvements to wonderful devices.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Healy. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.